Back, we had a good time last week. We were away for a wedding, and it went well. We had a great time. We enjoyed it. Full disclosure here, I am exhausted. I was just telling Jenna in the back, I am so tired. So I don't want anybody looking at me and think, is he sick? Is something wrong? No, I'm just tired. I'm a little tired. There really is a lot that goes into a funeral, you know. Not just the strategic and, logistics of it, but especially when you're really close to somebody, you know, somebody who's been not only a faithful member here of the church and active and not just, you know, showing up, but just really, just really bringing her great spirit. But she was such a great friend, you know, and she meant so much to me since I've been here. And so it was great to have that send-off, all of Miss Leveda's family who was here. That was great to see all of them, and they really had a great time, and they really appreciate church. In fact, you'll notice we haven't even quite finished putting everything back the way it's supposed to be. I was just too tired. But, you know, the flowers is a nice touch. What I want to do today is finish up where we started a couple months ago, talking about what it means to be the salt of the earth and what it means to be the light of the world. When we started on this and talking about being the salt of the earth, we pointed out how part of being the salt of the earth is that, you know, Jesus showed us through his example that it's not enough to just look at something and see something and speak about something, but that salt is effective when it comes in direct contact. That if salt doesn't actually engage with a substance, that it can't change that substance. You know, we talked about, as we've been talking about being the light of the world, how your light shining is not just this nice little saying, but that is a very intentional thing, that you have to look for ways in which you can shine your light, that you can get distracted, and that it's important that we be diligent about making sure that we always set a Christ-like example. And I want to finish today by dealing with a word that sometimes we may think of this when it comes to our walk with God, but very often we may not really give enough attention to it. But that word is expectation. And not just an expectation as far as what are the expectations that God has of us as children, but expectation even from the standpoint of what do I expect to happen? What do I expect from my own life? When I go and do the things out of obedience that I am asked to do by God, what do I expect the outcome to be? You know, when we go to work, you know, it's very simple, right? You go to work, you work, and most of us, you know, some of us, we go to work, and then we expect after, what, 2 weeks, you're going to get a check. You expect to get paid. That's a reasonable expectation. Now, on the other hand, if you took 3 or 4 days off, you expect that check to be a little bit less, right? Sometimes. You know, other times you're like, well, I'm on salary, I'm okay. But if you continue that same behavior, then you have a reasonable expectation, if you don't show up to work, of what? Getting fired. Being replaced. We have expectations in this world. And yet, when it comes to our faith, when it comes to what it is that we do in honor and in service to God, when we worship him, what is it that we expect? Because when we expect something, you know, I bring this up because Christmas is right around the corner, and I still have young children in my home. So there's an expectation coming up in a couple of weeks. And, you know, they play the game, and you know, the whole, okay, well, Santa gonna bring something? It's like, well, if you're expecting Santa to bring it, why do you keep asking me? Because they know that, yeah, well, we talk about Santa at school and everything, But deep down inside, they fully expect that it's me. In fact, William even said to me, this was a couple days ago, he said he wants a Nintendo Switch, right? And he says, now, I know that we talk about Santa and stuff. He was like, does Kendall know? I said, yes, Kendall knows there's no Santa. He said, okay. He says, do you have enough money for this? I said, well, son, I didn't even say I was going to get you the Nintendo Switch, first of all. Secondly, if I were to, let's say, do this, I think I got it. I think I can handle it. He says, okay, I just want to make sure. See, here's the thing. My son doesn't know how to quantify and make sense of how much money. He knows it costs $300, but he doesn't really know, well, what is $300? He knows what it means to him because he's been asking me for months, like, well, how many chores and can you give me a job to do? Can I help you outside? Can I do something? I want to make sure I have this thing. He understands, even if he can't quantify it, he understands that there's an expectation that I'm not just going to walk into Best Buy or Walmart and just start taking stuff. There's an expectation that I've got to exchange some money. Do we have that same expectation when it comes to our faith? For all of the time that we spend seeking God, praising Him, praying to Him, serving others, loving people. See, what do we expect on the other end of that? If we really expect something great, then what does God expect from us? You know, there's this thing, a friend of mine, we joke about this, we call it the bare minimum spirit. Where sometimes people have that attitude where they want to give the bare minimum but get the most. And we look at that, we think, and you know, we've all worked those jobs where it's like there's that one person or there may be a bunch of them where it's like they show up, they clock in, and they do the bare minimum just to stay employed. And you think, man, where's the excellence in that? You know, how can you really say that you appreciate and you're grateful to even have the job if you barely want to put in, you barely invest into this relationship, you barely put anything into your car, but you expect it to run? We have these expectations of things to work. Do we have the same expectations of our faith? The title of the sermon today is Something for Nothing. Something for nothing. And because of how we had to set up for the service yesterday, I don't have the aid of technology, so I'm going to be working with you by reading from the backdrop as well. But something for nothing, because very often when we think of faith, when we think of what it means, we can complain. You know, I talked about that yesterday with Miss Levada in her service. You know, people complain and they get upset and they get disappointed at the results. They get disappointed when they feel like, well, I just don't feel like I'm getting what I want or what I feel like I should be getting from God. But in reality, the question we have to ask ourselves is, well, what have you put into it? What have you actually invested into your relationship with God? And then if you've invested very little, then what do you expect? There's a term that some of you may not be familiar with, but it's called benign neglect. Now, there's several different meanings and ways in which you can apply this term, benign neglect. This actually is very popular, or became very popular politically, because they talked about investing, or rather divesting from communities. This was back in the 60s. This became a big deal, because basically benign neglect says, and what they did was they would have these communities. They said, okay, well, we're not going to, you know, come down on these communities. We're not going to hurt them. We're not going to target them. We're just going to divest. We're going to withdraw. We're going to put nothing into them, and then we'll just let whatever happens happen, right? It's the idea that I'm not going to do anything actively to tear it down, but I'm also not going to build it up. We're just going to see what happens. And then what would happen was later on, when things began to fall apart and degrade, when there were losses, when crime was rampant, when the property value started to go down, then people would say, well, see, this wasn't worthwhile anyway. But the fact is, it was a systematic effort to just not invest. You know, this is a Warren Buffett. He talks about investment. He says, benign neglect bordering on sloth remains the hallmark of our investment process. Again, this is that bare minimum thing. It's like, you know, I expect these things. I want these things to happen, you know, but I only want to put so much in my savings account. So what do? We focus so much on the interest rate that we forget you still got to put more than a dollar in there. Otherwise that, you know, because 10% might be great, but what's 10% of a dollar, you know? It's what you put in. You know, I like this one. Saying it's not your problem doesn't make it any less your problem. This idea that, you know, I'm just going to sit and watch and see, and I'm going to be at a distance because it doesn't affect me. But the fact is, just because you're not investing time, resources, energy, money, whatever it is, just because you're not investing it doesn't mean that it's going to go away. Just because you don't give attention to your health doesn't mean it's going to get better because you ignored it. I want to look at a passage that speaks of this, but when you think about what it means to do something with benign neglect, when you divest from something, the question you then have to ask yourself is, am I really doing this in good faith? We talk about faith a lot. That's what our Christian walk is about. It's about faith in God. But even that term, in good faith, what does in good faith mean? In good faith is basically the idea, and I'll get back into this in a little more detail in a second, but it's the idea that two parties agree contractually, or they come to terms on something, and the idea that if something breaks down or falls apart or it doesn't happen the right way, things don't go as planned, you trust that the other party did this in good faith, that they really showed up and that both parties tried, that if it maybe falls apart, it doesn't work out, or you don't get what you expect, it's not because the other person came into it with the attitude of benign neglect, that I'm really not in this 100%. Let's look at a passage in James chapter 2. James chapter 2, it talks a little bit about faith here. It says, what good is it, my brothers and sisters, if someone claims to have faith but has no deeds? Can such faith save them? Suppose a brother or sister is without clothes and daily food. If one of you says to them, go in peace, keep warm and well fed, but does nothing about their physical needs, what good is it? In the same way, faith by itself, if it is not accompanied by action, is dead. But someone will say, you have faith, I have deeds. Show me your faith without deeds, and I will show you my faith by my deeds. You believe that there is one God. Good. Even the demons believe that and shudder. You foolish person, do you want evidence that faith without deeds is useless? Was not our father Abraham considered righteous for what he did when he offered his son Isaac on the altar? You see that his faith and his actions were working together, and his faith was made complete by what he did. And the scripture was fulfilled that says, Abraham believed God, and it was credited to him as righteousness, and he was called God's friend. You see that a person is considered righteous by what they do and not by faith alone. In the same way, was not even Rahab the prostitute considered righteous for what she did when she gave lodging to the spies and sent them off in a different direction? As the body without the spirit is dead, so faith without deeds is dead. We see here in this passage is talking about the difference between faith, and understand when it says faith without deeds, what it's really saying is a statement of faith, a declaration of faith, you saying and speaking and making this declaration in and of itself is meaningless, it is worthless, It is dead if you're not willing to actually put something behind it. He used the example of saying, hey, you know what? Keep warm and well fed. You know, it's wintertime. It's cold outside. Telling someone, hey, I'm going to pray for you. I wish you the best. I hope that you stay warm. That in and of itself is not the same as, let me buy you a coat. Let me help you with your bill so that you can keep your heat on. Let's see if we can find a way to fix your situation. This person's hungry. They're starving. They're not able to make it for their family. Saying, man, you know what? I hope someone comes along. I'm going to pray that someone comes along without doing anything about it, because you, in fact, have the ability to help them. They're saying, your faith is useless. See, Abraham, and he used the example of Abraham here and Rahab here. We'll deal with this for a minute here. Abraham didn't just say, I believe. Keep in mind now, Abraham, at the point where he is giving up his son, this was not just a statement of faith on his part that I believe. Abraham had already proved over and over and over again through his deeds that he believed in this God. He left his home. And not only did it say leave your home and go move somewhere else because I'm going to do something different with you, Abraham, but no, he left his home, so he moved to a different place, said leave your family as well. Now, initially, he brought Lot and, you know, brought his dad, and he got halfway. He got halfway to his place, stopped at Haran, and God's like, no, this wasn't actually what I told you to do. He had to complete his faith. He had to continue. He had to not only leave where he grew up and where he was raised, but he left all of those people, him and Sarah. He starts something new. And then he says, even though you've already shown me your faith, I need you to show me again. I am asking you to give me your son. You believe that all these things that I revealed to you, that I can do these things, that I am the one true living God. Show me that you believe it. And you with your at this point, he's about 100 years old, right? You with your 100-year-old self, I want you to now go worship on this mountain. I want you to take your son with you, and I want you to sacrifice him. He's got one child. He's got one heir. I want you to believe in this promise. You're going to be the father of many nations, and it's going to be so many children and great-grandchildren. The extensions of your family are going to be so many. You won't be able to count them. But I want you to give up, and I want you to sacrifice the heir in which all of those are going to come through. Now, reasonably, especially for me, I'm thinking to myself, I won't even talk about you. Just for me, I'm thinking, you know what? If he had said, no, God, this doesn't make sense. I don't feel too good about that. That would actually be something that reasonably for me, I would say, you know what? I kind of get it, Abraham. I kind of understand. But what we see, and the reason why Abraham is pointed out here, is because his faith was matched by his investment. Because, you know, it's one thing to say, hey, I trust you. I think you're a great financial advisor, sir. Okay, great. Give me everything you've got and put it in this investment. And you're going to get a return that you won't even be able to count. See, it's easy in theory, just like God and what we read in the Word. It's easy in theory a lot of times, but when it comes to actually living it, suddenly that investment looks a little bit different. Suddenly, you realize what real faith has to be for us. We can't say, oh, you know, I really believe in the work that the church is doing. Well, does your financial contribution show that? Well, I really believe in the work that we're doing, and I believe in the ministries, and I believe that, you know, when we come together and we study the Bible and we share the Word and we give to people, I believe in this. Well, do you show up? What is your faith saying, not from your mouth, but by how you're living? Our investment in the work of the Lord is a direct reflection of our faith beyond just our words. Because our words are going to say a lot of things, and, you know, there's a lot that's going to come with our words. People can say a lot of things. People can sound really good. You know, I get up here and I preach, and I can say a lot of things, and it may sound really good, but the fact of the matter is my life has to match what I say. What good would it be for me to stand up here and say, hey, you know, you need to read your Bible, and you need to pray, and you need to give it to God, and you need to forgive, and what? But then I'm walking around holding a grudge. You would look and you would see, you know what? He may talk a good game. It may sound good. It may even make sense. It may even be doctrinally sound. But I'm looking at the way that this person walks. I'm looking at how much they invest. They're telling me to invest everything, but have they given their all? Does their faith reflect that they've given their all? You know, we talked about that good faith investment. That good faith, you know, what does that mean? It means that two people come into agreement, and when you agree, whether it's a contract or you agree to barter on something, it means that both parties genuinely believe that what they're doing it based on what they've said. That there's no ulterior motives, that there's no deception involved. A good example of this would be when two people come together and get married, that they're actually coming to get married and they really intend to stay together. That's an example of good faith. Another example is in the contract. It's like when you go to the auto dealership and you sign your name on the contract and they give you the 60 months and it's, you know, 8.5% or whatever the percentage is for this used car you just bought. And the contract basically stipulates that whatever the warranty says, however many miles it is, however many years it is, that the good faith effort on the part of the dealership is that we're going to honor our warranty. And the good faith effort on your part is that I'm going to pay you every month until this car is paid off. That's what a good faith effort between two parties means. When we think about what it is that we expect out of our relationship with God, what he calls us to do, and then what he expects us to do, the question we have to ask ourselves is, are we actually engaging in good faith with God? Are we expecting God to hold up his end of the bargain, but we're doing the bare minimum or sometimes even less when it comes to our investment? You know, we handshake with the Lord when we accept him. We agree. But do we actually engage in good faith? I want to look at an example of this that maybe we haven't considered as a matter of bad faith, but it's very appropriate. I want to look here in Matthew chapter 25, starting in verse 14. I want to read through this entire story. It says, again, it will be like a man going on a journey who called his servants and entrusted his wealth to them. To one he gave 5 bags of gold, to another 2 bags, and to another 1 bag, each according to his ability. Then he went on his journey. The man who received 5 bags of gold went at once and put his money to work and gained 5 bags more. So also the one with 2 bags of gold gained 2 more. But the man who had received 1 bag went off, dug a hole in the ground, and hid his master's money. After a long time, the master of those servants returned and settled accounts with them. Settled accounts means he came back with an expectation that what he entrusted them with, what he gave them to invest, he would come back and get a return. The man who had received 5 bags of gold brought the other 5. Master, he said, you've entrusted me with 5 bags of gold. See, I've gained 5 more. His master replied, well done, good and faithful servant. You have been faithful with a few things, in charge of many things. Come and share your master's happiness. The man with 2 bags of gold also came. Master, he said, you entrusted me with 2 bags of gold. See, I have gained 2 more. His master replied, well done, good and faithful servant. You've been faithful with a few things. I will put you in charge of many things. come and share your master's happiness. Then the man who had received one bag of gold came. Master, he said, I knew that you are a hard man, harvesting where you have not sown and gathering where you have not scattered seed. So I was afraid, and I went out and hid your gold in the ground. See, here's what belongs to you. His master replied, you wicked, lazy servant. So you knew that I harvest where I have not sown and gather where I have not scattered seed. Well, then you should have put my money on deposit with the bankers so that when I return, I would have received it back with interest. So take the bag of gold from him and give it to the one who has 10 bags. For whoever has will be given more, and they will have an abundance. Whoever does not have, even what they have will be taken from them. And throw that worthless servant outside into the darkness, where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. We see here this expectation that God has. We see that the one servant who just didn't feel like it was fair. Now, never mind the fact that he didn't give the person with the one bag of gold five, because he knew that that was too much to expect of him. Yet, he levied the charge against the master that he was unfair. He levied the charge against him that he somehow was heaping these expectations on him that were too hard. He said, no, I gave you one. I gave you one bag. I gave you one bag of gold, and I gave you more than enough time between the time that I left and the time that I came back. You think about time, and I even shared this yesterday, how very often we make excuses that we don't have enough, that we don't have enough resources, we don't have enough tools, or we just don't have enough time. But what we see from this passage is, what did you do with the time that you had? What did you do with the investment that you had? Because, see, sometimes we can complain and feel like we just don't have enough, when in reality, we have more than enough to do what God expected of us. But we're just not bartering. We're not exchanging. We're not representing ourselves to the Lord in good faith. We want to receive, but do we really want to give like it is being asked of us? We see here, and I talked about this a little bit with Abraham, and I said, I'll be honest with you. I'm a little bit, you know, I really respect Abraham, because it takes a lot to step out on faith and be willing to give up your heir. Be willing to give up your son. Like Abraham, I only have one. And so it would be a lot for me to do that. And so that fear is understandable. That apprehension is understandable. But when you consider the God of the universe, when you consider what it is that we expect of God and what we say about our faith in God, that he can do anything, that he can do all things, that nothing is impossible for God, do we invest in our relationship? Do we invest in the work that we're asked to do? Do we invest in the church? Do we invest our time in our brothers and sisters as though we really believe it? Is it actually in good faith? The fear of being inadequate, which is real for anybody, is a result of lacking faith. When you feel inadequate, it's a result of lacking faith. But it's not an excuse. It doesn't give us a way. We don't just get out of the contract just because we feel inadequate. It requires us. He says, at the very least, you could have given it to the bankers. You know, back then, you know, that wasn't really a good thing. You know, bankers weren't considered positive. It wasn't like going down and saying, hey, I'm going to just go see Denise tomorrow. I'll go over to M&T and I'll give some money. No, that wasn't how it worked. Bankers back then were considered corrupt. They weren't trustworthy. But at least, even though they would exploit, at least I would have gotten something. God has given us so much. when he asks us to be the light of the world, when he asks us to shine the light and reflect Christ, when he asks us to be the salt of the earth, to touch people, to impact people, to have a direct impact on those around us, sometimes we have to ask ourselves, is it really too much to do? Because sometimes I feel like, well, yeah, you know, I know Wednesday night we have Bible study, and I know I could probably give an extra $20 or I know that I could do certain things. I know I could maybe have a Bible study in my home, or, you know, I could talk to people, you know, at my job or in my neighborhood about studying the Bible. Or do they have, are they hurting? Is there something I can pray for them for? But that just seems like it's a little too much. It's a little too inconvenient. It just feels like I'm extending myself just a little too far. But is that the attitude of someone who really understands the treasure that they've been given, the expectation that comes with being a follower of Christ? A few questions I want to ask as we move forward here and close out. Do I invest my resources, being time, money, prayer, study, etc., as someone that will have to give an account for the return? Do I invest, do I put the energy in to my relationship with God? Does my faith reflect that I'm really into this? You know, I think about people, you know, if you don't study hard, if you, you know, and then you go in and you take a test, you know that you're going to be graded on that test. You know that at some point you're going to have to take this test. And if you don't study, if you don't go to the lectures, if you don't go to class, if you're not doing the research, what grade would you expect? If you don't change your oil, this only happened to me one time. It was a car. I was so busy. I was caught up. I wasn't changing the oil like I needed to. And then one day, I kind of heard a really loud ticking that just progressively got worse. And I kept, you know, I was engaging in all kinds of denial. But I knew what it was. I knew exactly what it was. The engine was breaking down because I kept running old oil in it. What did I expect? Do I invest my money into the church, into other people, into giving and being charitable and serving and sacrificing? Do I do it like I expect to be held accountable for it? Because sometimes we treat it like it's our stuff, it's our time. Those are my clothes, and that's my car, and that's my house, and these are my things, as though we're not going to have to give an account. Do we live like somebody's going to come and hold us accountable? It's beautiful having children because children know that I'm going to come in and I'm not just going to do bed check, but I'm going to walk around, I'm going to look in the room. And they know that I expect them to clean their room and I expect them to put their shoes where they belong, put the coat up where it belongs, throw your stuff away when you get done eating. There's expectations for children in my house. Do we live like we have expectations that God is going to hold us accountable someday? Who in the church needs to invest more for it to be a place where God can get his full return? And how much more? I said who because, and I asked that question that way on purpose, because a lot of times we look and we can think, you know what? I kind of need Dennis to invest a little bit more. I kind of need Ms. Shanita to invest a little bit more. You know, Megan here, you know, that was great. I love the cabbage yesterday, but I need you to invest a little bit more. We can look around and think other people need to contribute more and do more and invest more and be more so that the church can then be more, so that the light can be seen. And we can forget that the who in this question is always answered as us. How much more do we need to invest in order for God to get his return? How much more do we need to invest? I mean, sometimes it could be. I just need to be more sacrificial. You know, I need to give more time. I need to be more involved. I need to give more money, whatever it is. Sometimes it could be, you know what? I just need, when I am involve, I need to have my heart there. Not just, you know, clock in. Not just be seen and be present, but actually be involved. To not just show up and say, hey, it was great to see, you know, Mark or Darlene at church, but I'm actually going to, you know, come up and talk to them. Mark will talk back to you. It's okay, you know. See, that's the thing. Sometimes we can forget that part of the investment is us actually showing up and being engaged. And it's not just, I need her or I need him or I need, in order for the church to be better, in order for us to be able to better reflect Christ, that these other people need to invest more. But it's actually us. God's going to get a full return on his investment. Do my deeds and actions reflect a person that is full of faith or just a busy worker? Do I work for the Lord on salary, commission, or an hourly basis? You know, I bring that up because, and I mentioned this earlier, I've worked on salary before and I've worked hourly. And let me tell you, there's a difference. There's a whole different attitude and spirit and mindset when you're working on salary or you're working on commission, like straight commission, and when you're working on an hourly basis. The way that you show up to work when you're working on straight commission, let me tell you something. I remember working on straight commission. I actually sold cars at two different dealerships. One of them, I was paid a partial hourly rate, and then I was paid commission on every car that I sold. And I hustled. But it was nothing like the hustle of I was being paid straight commission. And if I didn't sell a car, I didn't get paid. I didn't eat. I'm telling you right now, it was cutthroat, right? Leroy's laughing. He knows. He's like, seriously, you see that old lady come in, and you're like, man, I know she's got some money. And she came in to buy. I saw the car she came in with. It was like a dogfight trying to get up there because you're on commission. If you don't sell a car, you don't get it. When you're an hourly worker, I was, you know, talking to Nico about this. When you're an hourly worker and then you miss a day, you miss a few hours, and you're like, man, that check felt good, but it didn't feel as good as it did last week because there's something missing. But that's because we have an expectation from the work. Do we work hard like someone who's hungry for it, someone who needs it? Or do we work like, you know what, I'm on salary, I'm going to get paid anyway. All I got to do is show up. Because there's a difference, and that's reflected in the way that we live. And finally, do I have faith that can save me or anyone else? What evidence do I have of this saving faith? Is your faith such that you can actually save? You know, it says that their faith saved them. Is your faith enough where it can save you or it can save someone else? Because that's what our faith is expected to do. When we live and we reflect Christ in our lives, the way that we have faith, the way that our faith is shown in how we live, it is expected to have an impact on people to save others, including saving ourselves. Do we have that kind of faith? Do we genuinely have the type of faith that can really impact and move people closer to God? Or is it faith in name only, not in deed? You know, you look at that one talent. Here's the thing. I imagine that the one talent person probably didn't have as many skills, probably didn't have as much education, didn't have as many resources, didn't have as much family support, maybe didn't have, you know, maybe they weren't particularly literate or educated. But even with that, it wasn't an excuse to say, then I'm not going to do anything. Sometimes we can look and think, well, you know what, I'm not a preacher. I'm not particularly religious even. I'm not the most spiritual person in the world. I've got a lot of struggles, and I haven't been in church very long. I'm probably not the best suited person to do what you do. But you can do what you can. And the question is, are you doing that? Are you doing at least what it is that's expected of you? Do you know what's expected of you? Is it expected of you to give your life to God? Yes. Have you done that? Have you made it a point that I'm going to surrender myself so that I can know what it is that's expected of me? That I can engage in that good faith agreement, that contract that says, I know where my salvation is, and I know that God will protect me and I'll be with him for eternity. But in exchange, I'm going to give him my life. Have you given your life? If you've never given your life, then you need to. Then you need to be able to say before you leave here that, you know what? I've done what I need to do to make sure that I'm right with God. Maybe you are someone who has. But as they might say, you've been slacking off on the job. You've been taking for granted that salary, and you haven't been hungry. You haven't been investing in your relationship with God. You haven't been investing like a man who truly has faith. If that's you, not only repent, but come forward. Come forward when we sing our song of invitation. Come forward so that you can get the prayers of the church. Allow your brothers and sisters to help you. Help you to see what it is that you're missing. But what we can't do is decide that, you know what, my little light isn't quite shining, that it's not as bright as it should be, and I'm okay with it. Because that's not a good faith effort. That's not bartering. That's not engaging with the Lord in good faith. He doesn't just expect us to show up here and sit down and listen. He expects us to go out and do. Are we willing to engage in good faith, in being the salt of the earth, in being the light of the world? Please stand as we sing our song of invitation.